Hello and welcome to the Music Retailers Podcast. I'm your host, Donovan Bankhead, and together you and I are going to listen to and learn from some of my favorite instrumental music retailers, manufacturers, well, anyone else that I think would be interesting. My goal is to provide a podcast where you can learn something new in every episode.
So we're going to launch right in it today. My guest is Crystal Morris from Gator Cases, and really excited to have you here, Crystal, to join me on the Music Retail Podcast. And I want to hear a little bit about, before we get into Gator Cases, I'd kind of like to hear about your background, both sort of personally and professionally, and then, you know, how that transforms into where your entry comes with Gator Cases. So yeah, can you give me the Cliff Notes version of that?
Cliff Notes version. Okay. Well, thank you, first of all, for having me. So I did grow up around this industry. My dad was in the industry. So I remember by middle school attending NAMM shows and never really dreamed I would end up here. I think during middle school, high school, into college, I thought I would be a lawyer. but somehow, I got out of college with a business degree, and my father had this idea of what he thought should be like what he called his real life MBA. So I spent, I thought, 2 years kind of learning all sorts of different odd trades, worked in different businesses, got my pilot's license, went to Costa Rica with the mission of learning to speak Spanish. To be truthful, I kind of just had fun. My Spanish is terrible. And then worked in several different businesses and a distributor and a freight forwarder, some different things. And at that point, you know, came to work with him. Never ended up going back to school at that point. So started working with his business, and he helped me get a role in marketing. So I was doing that, and then ended up moving to Tampa and going back to school to get my MBA. And while I was doing that, he parted ways with a different case company, and we're like, well, forget it. We can do our own case company. So literally around the kitchen table, we dreamed this thing up. I was, you know, like I said, I was in business school. So I was like, well, we can use this variable cost model, so we don't have to put a lot of capital in. We can basically outsource everything to get started. And so in my guest bedroom, I was doing everything from, you know, setting up a GL structure to marketing, invoicing. And my dad started doing sales and product development. And that's how it got started.
That's amazing. So
that's kind of the story of how Gator got started. And I guess personally, I have two sons. One of them is in college at West Point. I'm very, very proud of him. And my other son is a junior in high school doing wonderful things. So we'll see what he does next. And I guess just for me, I love adventure and traveling. I love to water ski, play tennis, boat, anything outdoors, fun. Exploring the world. So
going to Costa Rica, not working in your Spanish.
Exactly. So that's the hopefully a good Cliff Notes version of how we got started.
Did you have a music background?
I didn't really have a music background. Growing up in a household that my dad worked in the industry, I took piano lessons for many years. So I played the piano a little bit. But quite frankly, somewhere in middle school, I was playing a lot of tennis. And I think my piano teacher told my mom, like, she might be better using her talents in sports. So yeah, around the middle, 7th, 8th grade, I got pretty serious playing competitive tennis and kind of gave it up.
Man, you and my wife would have a great time because she's a musician, but she lives for tennis.
Okay,
now good. She's 5'1", which not a lot of professional tennis players are 5'1", but she's got a serve that will just, you know, cripple you for sure.
Ooh, so she's like some big spin or something.
Yeah she's all every once in a while, well, not anymore because I'm too old and she could hurt me, but we would sometimes play, and if I was lucky enough to get a point on her, which was only usually because she would go easy on me, you know, so that I would keep coming back to play, then she would like just serve one up and roast me with it. I'm like, okay, never mind.
I definitely do have hype on my side for tennis, but
Yeah,
unfortunately, I don't really get to play that much these days.
That's too bad.
One of these days.
So are your kids interested in the business? Do you think that at some point they may continue making a family business, or are they going to go off and pursue something else?
Yeah, I haven't really encouraged that. Kind of encouraged them to find their own way. And quite frankly, I think what I would prefer to do is help them start their own business. maybe because that was the route, you know, I went with my dad, and kind of, there's just something to being a piece of all the little beginnings. And so that's kind of the vision I have for it. But I don't know, we'll see how it goes.
Interesting. So what do you think was the key? I mean, obviously the education and your dad getting involved, but what was the key in making Gator Cases be successful? Because it's not just the variable cost model and those kinds of things, you know, and there's other case company and that type of supplier. But what was the thing, do you think, that kind of gave you that drive and the ability to sort of break through and make this Gator company a thing that would be successful and last?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, in the very early days when we started, we first of all kind of changed the distribution model. So the primary kind of players in the space were all selling through distributors to dealers. And we went dealer direct, which, you know, had a lot of positives in terms of the fact that we were just getting really fast feedback, like, hey, you guys should make this. What if you guys do this? So we were able to learn, I think, a lot faster from the market. Obviously, by cutting out a layer of distribution, that, you know, allows there to be more margin. So we were able to price the product better into the marketplace. So I feel like we came out with really good product to start with. And then we were working directly with the retailers, hearing the voice of the customer. And then that really just, that shed on the light to us that we really needed to kind of be a one stop. So there were people out there, you know, that kind of specialized in making plastics, some other people that were good in woods, some people that did bags. And we really took the approach of quickly exploring how do we get into all these different materials. And then at the same time, kind of the same thing where there's people that lived in a lane of plastic versus wood versus sewn, different types of plastics. There are also some people that really lived in lanes for like who the customer was. So, you know, some people were focused on guitar, some people were more pro audio, some people were DJ. And we really kind of wanted to just capture all of that and do it well, but be like one really solid solution. And so, you know, I think a lot of that came from that, those being able to be working directly with the customers and hearing like, hey, it'd be great if you made this. Hey, have you thought about making that? We like doing business with you, but we still have to buy from somebody else because you don't make this. So that really, I think, led towards, you know, how we have expanded the product line pretty aggressively, you know, through all the years.
And am I correct in saying that you don't actually own any of the manufacturing, so you can essentially partner with manufacturing companies that have those strengths? Is that essentially kind of your
mostly
model?
Mostly, I mean, so for mostly. So we do own a factory in Indiana. We do one kind of two things there. We do rotational molding of plastic. So certain lines of our cases are made in Indiana. And then also we do some metal working there. And so in some assembly work there. So we do some manufacturing in the US. We also own a company by the name of Levy's. So all of Levy's strap company has a, you know, very, very long legacy, all made in Canada. So we have a factory up in Nova Scotia, Canada, that's full of amazing artisans making these products. And then we actually have a joint venture factory that we do in Vietnam. So that's also the, you know, a factory we're running. And then the rest of our partners are factory partners, but yes, we can like scale and move around. So,
in the early days, certainly the Levy's thing is somewhat recent. Yeah. In the early days, you probably didn't have any of these factories,
none of it,
right?
Yeah,
you're essentially,
none of it. Yes. And essentially we were sourcing, we found a really great partner early on. We kind of just tied each other together, you know, like we just really linked up together. He pretty much started, you know, doing all the production with us. We grew together. Hey, let's get into this type. We figured out the manufacturing and he did it. So, so although we didn't have an ownership in it, it's always been like a very, very close partnership.
Well, and like you mentioned, being able to go direct to dealer and getting that feedback so quickly, being able to make product improvements probably allowed you to have iterations of products changing very quickly and make quality changes and also even maybe feature changes and implementation for people that like, this would be great if it had X, Y, or Z or whatever, to kind of quickly move up from just being like a case maker to actually like doing something kind of innovative and unique and different.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about listening, right? And there's just so many solutions. And then as like, I mean, we kind of follow the market, right? So like take when the X32 came out, right? I mean, all of a sudden everyone's like, hey, you guys need an X32 case. And we're you know, all over it. So as soon as we get that kind of feedback, but we can't make a case until that product came out, right? So,
right.
So we have to wait for, you know, those kind of things to happen. But in other times, obviously a guitar isn't changing, right? So it's how do we innovate how people carry it, how it's protected, how it's used, how it's stored, the look of it, those kind of things.
That's interesting because you mentioned that, of course, and because I'm mainly a guitar, bass guitar player and trumpet player, I tend to think more of those products than I do like mixing board cases and stuff like that. And you're right, the size and shape of the bass guitar or the trumpet hasn't changed much. Exactly. So it's pretty easy to make cases for it. But when we think of technology products, that's a different ball game. And when we think of like, you know, the iPhone 13 that just was released, we know Apple will release at least sizing specs and models to some of their accessory partners so that they can start making cases. And so that at launch, there would be iPhone 13 cases and stuff like that. Does nothing like that exist for MI? I would imagine it's not because, you know,
I mean, it sells a little bit.
Whatever breakout hit the X32 was probably didn't sell anywhere near the amount of iPhone 13s that got sold. So
no, I don't think so. I already got my iPhone 13. we do have a lot of manufacturers we partner with that will, you know, give us the heads up. Now, can we perfectly time it like that? Not often, but, you know, we can be pretty close on their heels.
Was there a singular kind of breakthrough product for Gator that just sort of like was a home run that you felt like kind of made you feel like, yeah, we can do this?
I don't know. I don't think there was like an exact moment like that. I mean, we just kept, you know, we really originally started with guitar cases, really branched into the pro audio keyboard kind of area next. And those, you know, there's just a lot of volume in that business. And I mean, to me, like, I guess there isn't that kind of moment where I was like, oh yeah, we've made it. It was more of this like evolution. And then all of a sudden, like I remember for years I'd be out and, you know, we'd see a band playing or I'd be traveling and I'd never see Gator stuff. I'd always see our competitors. And right. Then one day I was like, oh, I started to see Gator stuff. And then a few more years go by and I'm like, oh, I see mostly Gator stuff. and now it's like, I mean, it's just so cool because when I'm out and about now, like, you know, any stage I walk up to, they have something of ours. So I think that to me, if you're just like how my internal, we kind of, okay, we've made it, was a little bit of just that kind of gut feel of like being in the market and like out there, people actually using the gear.
Yeah.
I did have a great story once. I was like, okay, this was a pretty cool story where there was a school music dealer who was outfitting all of their instruments, rental instruments in Gator cases. And the store owner's niece had an instrument. I think she must've been like very early in the band program. And somebody asked her, well, what, you know, what's the instrument do you play? And she said, I play a Gator. I was like, okay, well, if she thinks her instrument's a Gator, that's great too.
That's perfect. That's perfect. So when did the Levy's deal take place, and kind of talk me through how that came to be? Because a strap company and case company it's not like an odd comparison, but it maybe wouldn't be the first thing that first partnership I would think of. Kind of walk me through how that deal came to be.
Sure. Yeah, I think our expertise is in the world of accessories because we really expanded with our Gator Frameworks line. So we have a full line of stands that's doing really, really well. A few years ago too, we also have something called Gator Rackwork. So it's all the install racks. So, I mean, we have expanded in these other ways out of cases. And I've kind of, as we evolve, I kind of like to think of us as an accessory company. And so things that are interesting to me are accessories, but they have to be things that are really high quality, have great brand reputation, only things that would complement what we're doing, not, you know, something we have to go back and like reestablish if there's quality or where they fit in the market. And then I guess just like kind of this passion for this industry and what it's made up of is there's just so many cool brands and companies where people started them and then they do it for 30, 40 years and they're not sure what to do with them. And here's Levy's who been around for 45 years and they're ready to retire. And it's like their last name. It's like, how can you be a good steward to a brand like that? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that was kind of how it came about. I kind of put the word out there that we we're looking for, you know, good, smart acquisitions. And if somebody brought it to me and said, hey, this could be of interest. It could be a good fit. You know, it's a great brand. So that's how it kind of came to us. And then we worked it out.
How many SKUs roughly are in the Gator catalog pre-levies?
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, that was a challenge with levies. there was a lot. We keep slowly limiting it. But with Gator, somewhere probably around 850 SKUs, something like that. Okay. I think when we got levies, it had like close to 4,000.
Right.
Yeah, that was a little overwhelming. I think out of the pretty close to, you know, the first 6 months or so, once we got our arms around it and realized how that just was not doable, we got it down to, I don't know, still a huge number, between 1,000 and 1,500. We keep limiting it. Now we're down to like, I think maybe 600 and something. It's just too many choices. It's like overwhelming. So there's a point where like you want something for everyone and a point where they're all doing the exact same thing and it's overwhelming.
Right.
So we have been limiting the catalog a little bit.
What kind of data are you using to make those decisions on what products get cut and which ones?
Yeah, obviously there is a whole piece of sell through. But one of the things that was interesting, like in that particular thing, is over the years, there was a lot of straps that were extremely similar, but with just slightly different shapes to the end, just very slight differences that, like, I think probably just was this organic. Some customer said like, oh, it'd be great if you did this. Sure, no problem. It would be great if you did this. So a lot of it was like realizing that there was a lot of duplication.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't like, it would be easy if there was five duplicates that don't add up to much sales, but if we add them all together, we could make one strap that actually is successful.
Right.
So that was a little, you know, that was a little complicated to wrap our minds around. So there was that piece. And then obviously just, you know, customer and demand.
Has the manufacturing remained up in Canada?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And is distribution handled from Cater down in the US or?
For the US market. Yes.
For the US market. Okay.
Yeah. So for the US market, we bring it all into our warehouse in Indiana and then, you know, redistribute it out. That way it can just go with the Gator, you know, Gator orders, and we have it in stock. We can ship really fast. So
how has the manufacturing process changed, and what are some of the challenges you ran into about, since, you know, it's not in your facility that you're at all the time, it's easier to manage and being in another country? Kind of, I don't have a lot of experience with that. So maybe just kind of walk me through some of the challenges.
So honestly, the team up there is and was great. I mean, they're really dedicated, passionate about what they do, really know the product. So I think, you know, our biggest mission was to just give them tools. They didn't have a good way of MRP system for, it was kind of done a little bit on, not a piece of paper, but not, you know, not with a lot of technology behind it. So we've helped with that. And then that's allowed us to get better metrics, which metrics can drive performance, can, you know, adjust, like where we maybe realize like we, you know, maybe have too many raw materials in a certain area, or maybe we have too much labor tied up in one area, but another area is a bottleneck. So, I mean, we've just been able to help them, I think, utilizing technology and data and adding some dashboards to better manage the facility. But I mean, there wasn't really a lot of work to do on the actual manufacturing side. The work really came from the things like what you brought up very, very wisely on the SKU count issue, really figuring out what the right catalog was, how to market it to get all the right marketing assets, to what the messaging was. Those kind of things have been, you know, really on the sales and marketing side, I would say have been our biggest opportunities and challenges. But I think we've really turned a lot of corners on that and really happy with where that is now.
It's kind of interesting.
The only other thing you kind of halfway mentioned that I think was interesting in a good way, but I don't think we like really took into account that there's a lot of cultural differences between Canada and the US. And there's management differences, legalist differences, and you know how you run a company. So that definitely was a bit of a learning curve. But I think in a really positive way.
Can you name a few examples that might stand out to, that would
I mean, it's just like, even like how you like approach people, you know, I think we're just tend to be a lot more direct, like Canadians are just a lot more polite, but maybe not like, you know, they actually, it's funny when we were kind of early and in, and one of the guys up there told me, Crystal, think about this. Like if there's an American, a US, you know, going up to the pool, they're gonna go for a swim. They go to the deep end and just jump in. A Canadian walks up to the edge of the pool and tests the water, puts their toe in, and then takes the steps in. And so he's like, you know, sometimes you guys are trying to run and just jump in, and we're going to get in, but we kind of need to like test it out, understand it, just a little bit different mentality.
I would have thought that there would have been, so when you have a company that is maybe used to doing things the way they've done it for 45 years, you know, maybe not using technology to make things efficient, used to doing like, oh yeah, we can do this one off, it's not a big deal. That then changing it to where it's maybe a little more bottom line focused, where it's a little more streamlined and organized, I would have felt like culturally that had the potential at least to have a lot of pushback and resistance. Yeah, did you really find that there, or did you find that they were kind of open and willing for change?
Really open, actually. Yeah, really open. And on, I think a lot of it was stuff that at the manufacturing management level, they've been really wanting. So,
gotcha.
You know, so I think a lot of it was things they didn't maybe know exactly how to get there, but knew that it was something they wanted.
Gotcha.
So yeah, I don't think it was like against, like this is how we've always done it. But you know, we didn't really run into that. It was just, I think it was more us trying to run fast and them kind of like wanting to, you know, slowly change. And we were kind of wanting to change fast. Right. Was probably more the difficulty. Like they were on board. It was just the speed of it.
Have they kept their same design team? Because so much of, you know, straps are almost as much a fashion item as they are an actual utility item. Or has that changed? Has some of the Gator design team been involved with that? Has there been any crossover?
Yeah, no, the Gator team is really involved in that. But quite frankly, when at the time we acquired Lovey's, they didn't really have much of a design team. Those skills, I think, are, you know, who used to do it wasn't doing it anymore. So it wasn't like that was like a real strength at the time that we acquired it. That was probably a weakness at that gotcha. Point in the business.
Gotcha. That's a strength that you were able to bring to the table.
That was a strength we had because we do have an entire design team.
Give me, and I remember even when the news came out that happened at the time, thinking that was surprising, but also interesting to sort of see. Because it was also during a time when there was some more competition than what there had been historically in the strap space. And that continues to change. And there's big competitors, and there's also lots of little boutique competitors. So probably a good move for Lovey's at that point to partner with someone that's got some experience to help them kind of, you know, move through some of those challenges. So
yes, yeah, no. And I think we just have, you know, a good channel with Gator. So we were able to really help use the Gator channel to kind of reestablish some of those Lovey's, retail spots.
Yeah. So getting back to you a little bit here, give me an idea of like what a typical day looks like for you. What time do you get into the office, and do you have like, are you kind of the person that thrives on routine? Like some of the people on my team, they live by structure and routine. Whereas I, you know, if I get in routine, I get bored and love it when there is no routine
like
and every
I'm
day is
like
different. So, okay. So tell me what that's like, what that means for you then.
Yeah. I'm kind of all over the place. It kind of just depends what's going on. What time, you know, my first meeting is sometimes like, and especially, you know, some of the changes with the pandemic, right. As everything is so easy to work remote now. So, I mean, there's sometimes like, there'll be a morning, like, you know what, I'm going to work from home. I have a ton of kind of emails or kind of things I want to be able to like, just kind of dig into without being interrupted. Sometimes I'll work from home. But for the most part, I get in between 8 and 9. I have my dog in tow. And I mean, if I'm in the office, it is just a lot of interaction. Like I'm pretty involved with every team. I like to get up, walk around, talk to people. People are kind of in and out of my office. And then we do have a little bit, I would say, tend to have a little bit of a meeting culture. I personally, I know a lot of people don't like meetings. I do like kind of set meetings with agendas because it just kind of keeps everyone like working towards something. So if we talk about a new project, then, you know, maybe I set something from a month later to check in on it. And, you know, so then those are coming up and we're checking on things. So, and then we do spend I do particularly spend a decent amount of time on like strategic growth initiatives. So really trying to drive those. So I spend, you know, a decent amount of time every week in different meetings working on where we're going, you know, because a lot of times you can get really, everybody, the team can get really dug in on what they're working on right now, what's coming at them right now. So, so I like to make sure I always try to, you know, continue to keep that bigger vision and everyone also working on that.
So clearly you're a visionary and clearly that it's a role that's kind of your responsibility, right? So everyone's got their, we always call it, it's elbows and assholes around this place. Yes. Like when everyone's just sort of like buried into their job, like you gotta have that one person who's like,
gotta have the dreamer.
It's like everybody's busy. Let me look ahead, see what's coming up ahead. Like, oh, hey, we need to do this thing or change, or I've got this other idea. I know that you don't want to hear it right now, but like, we need to start thinking about it or whatever. You've got to have that person that can do that. It's an important role.
Yeah, I mean, we're a product company, right? So we got to stay ahead of the product. We got to be coming out with great new product. And then, I mean, you know, it's always this hybrid, because it doesn't matter what you do downstream if you don't have the right product. So got to start with making the right product, but then you got to make a great customer experience too. So, so continually trying to drive how we can be better at that. And then I personally also love all the marketing stuff. So how do we get the word out? And as you know, I mean, that's just every year, every month, you know, that's just evolving. How do you talk to your customers? How do you have a voice? Where do you find them? So it's just like, you know, there's a lot of great things to think about and how you push those forward while you're firefighting, you know, the orders that are coming in. Or, you know, this year has all been about supply chain. So all the craziness in supply chain. So you kind of got to, you know, you got to firefight and you also have to look out ahead, right? So.
So you've mentioned a couple of things here that I'm jotting down that I want to make sure I address. Supply chain issue, I think I'm going to pass on that one just because we all know that the supply chain's effed up. So, and I would imagine there's parts of it that flow freely and then other parts that are completely log jammed, and you know, you just take what you can get and kind of move forward with it. So at least, actually, I'm going to reverse this decision. I want to hear a little bit of how you've dealt with it. Because on our end, that's what we do. We find like, well, we can't get this from the supplier, so we're off to the next. And we've got our buyer just does really a great job of tracking that down. You guys can't really do that so much. So tell me, like, how have you been able to kind of navigate around these supply? Because that would be interesting for you.
I mean, there's, you know, it's just a huge problem because there's just not. I mean, it's just been a moving target of what the problem is since COVID started, right? So at one point we couldn't get anything made. And then, you know, right now you can't get anything shipped. So there's just not enough containers to ship things and the costs are completely exorbitant. So we're just trying to make the best use of our money and the space we can get, right? So how do we put the stuff on the ships that people want the most and that can turn the fastest? And, you know, we hate to make those choices, but there's, you know, when you have capacity issues, you got to pick the winners, right? So
you're basically in the same boat that we're in. You know, we do the same thing. We have things we prefer, but right now it's, well, what can we get? Yeah. And the nice thing about where the marketplace is at right now, the customer base will basically buy the product you can get. So, and it's not always terrible. We're dealing with an issue this morning of, we have directors that, for some rental programs that prefer a certain model of instrument that's kind of a niche and hard to get that model right now. It's like, well, I think they'll likely allow us to sub anything we want.
Yeah, if they can just get playing, right?
Yeah, if we've got a bunch of stuff on the shelf, let's just sub that, and I bet it'll be okay. Yeah. This is the one year that we can get away with this, so let's get it off the shelf and turn it.
Who knows? Yeah, maybe they'll love the thing you sub in, and that's what they'll want in the future.
Probably not, but there's a chance. So you mentioned product, and you must have a system that you use for product development. kind of walk me through what that looks like for when you're coming up with a new product. What does that process look like?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, first of all, I think I really kind of pride ourselves in really listening to the market, listening to the customers, talking to the customers, like people that are out there on the front line selling it and using the gear. So as ideas are coming in, I mean, there's no shortage of ideas, quite frankly. So, you know, kind of the first step is how do you drill through a ton of ideas into the amount that you can actually go execute on. So we have a process where we write business cases. So we, you know, do a pretty in-depth study of what the product's going to be, what the feature set's going to be, where it's going to fit in the market, and, you know, best guess of how many of these things we could sell. I love it when we have internal advocates or endorsers of the product, right? That they're really passionate about bringing this to market. You know, maybe it's a salesperson, maybe it's on the marketing team, maybe it's myself. And so that's kind of the beginning of it. So we write the business case, and then we have an industrial design team who goes to work on designing it. You know, we kind of just have a set of values of what we do in terms of wanting to deliver something that's high quality, that adds solutions. You know, we want those like aha moments, like, oh, wow, they thought of this. And we want them to just trust us, like trust in what they're going to get from us, that, you know, we get that we're like protecting the gear people love, right? That's letting them do whatever they want to do, if it's their passion, if it's their business. So we just need them to count on us. We just need to deliver something they know is going to work, going to solve the issue they have, the moving it around, the storing it, and just give them a good experience. So that's what we really designed to. You know, and then we want to be value oriented. So like a fair price for what you're getting. Definitely have no desire to be the cheapest, but we don't need to be the Rolex either. We want to perform, get a performance product. So that's kind of what the design team goes to work on. And so they, you know, do some drawings, come up with concepts, we review them, and then we get samples made. We pick the partner we're going to work with on it. And then, you know, it comes back and we start the whole, like, as we get, you know, final samples, we start the whole marketing chain of getting photography and video and getting it out to market.
I think there's so many kind of relevancies between that process and maybe a process a retailer might use if they're coming up with something that they want to retool. Maybe if you have a lesson program, a rental program, some kind of service that you're offering, you can use that same kind of process of like, have a team together, kind of write together essentially what you're trying to do here, sort of what your plan is for this product, what the specs should be, what are the issues that a customer will want to see, what are some of the problems they would expect, and kind of solve all that. Having an internal advocate, obviously, you're right, that helps. There's times where we try to push something through and it's like there's sort of no one championing it. Yep. We just feel like we should do it.
That stuff
just
takes seems forever.
but
everyone's kind of a little like, yeah, we should do it. But it's, yeah.
But when they're excited about it, that can be really different. And so, yeah, I think being very intentional about that process. And I think it's one of the things I feel very fortunate about, you know, with the size of our company, we're large enough that we have several people that kind of serve as this leadership team. And so when we want to do something, I always have a sounding board of people that I can pull together for that. And sometimes when you have very small companies, it can be very difficult for them. I work with a few small companies that are like that, where they're very smart people. They're very capable. I just mixed up people and capable at the same time, but they're very smart people.
You got a place in the dictionary now.
Yeah, exactly. But they just, it's often just a matter of resources. And by resources, not necessarily time or money, as much as it is capital of other people's interest to help them lead their companies can be really challenging. And so it sounds like you've got a great team there
I do think like and it's interesting. I think maybe you can kind of relate to this. And I think to grow a company and to scale it, you have to like ahead of when you need the people, you have to hire them. And it's like a huge expense at the time you do it. Like, you know, it's like painful. Like this is painful, but I know I need more human capital to get where I want to go. And if I look back, like some of the bigger moves I've made in bringing in people, that it was a stretch. It was hard to like stomach it in the budget.
Yeah.
Were the people I would say have gotten us like each time to the next level. So, but it's hard, right? So
that's probably a nugget right there. There, anyone who's listening up to this point, that may be like, yeah, kind of interesting. That point right there, you're right. That because I think through that, and I think through just through Springfield Music's history, I know there was a big acquisition that mainly got us our the person who heads up our repair shop 20 something years ago. And it was, you know, a big pill to swallow to do it, but they did it. Yeah. And him being here ended up bringing me here, which at the time was a very difficult expense for the business to take, but obviously worked out stupidly well.
clearly.
And then there's a number of other employees that kind of come to mind, but just thinking of the last 4 years ago, we hired a VP of finance. And up until that point, I'd kind of been doing it, but with my degree in music education. And but we had hired someone with an MBA, and like at the time, that was a big investment for us to do and was kind of painful, but has just really paid off in spades and allowed us to clean up issues and grow in ways we wouldn't have been able to otherwise. And I know right now I've got another hire that I want to make that I've been kind of waiting on over the last year because I kind of don't want to put the money into it, but I know I need to and I should. And listening to you say that's giving me the motivation I need to just bite the bullet and do it. Because you're right, it's painful at the time, but if it's the right plan, it's the right idea, then it'll be worth it.
And I will say the other thing on that is that, like, if you believe in the plan, there's a chance you won't get the right person the first time. Like, you can't give up, right? Like, you know, it's right to add the VP of finance, but maybe someone interviews great and you get them in, it's not the right fit.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean like do away with the idea. It means like you got the wrong person, but the right idea.
And that's what happened to us. So we had this role. I have filled it once with a total wrong person, very nice person. Just wasn't the right fit for what we needed. And we probably didn't do a great job onboarding them and getting them ready, but they also just weren't the right fit. I think if we would have nailed the execution on our end perfectly, it still wouldn't have worked. And because it was a new position and it just failed from the get-go, it sort of took the wind out of the sails. And then the pandemic hit shortly after that. And so I think it's time to kind of relook at that again.
Yeah.
But you're right. Yeah. Just because it doesn't work, because you bring the wrong person in.
Yeah.
Can't let that make it stop.
Give up on the idea.
Yeah. Well, I feel like I should send you a check for this session, if nothing else.
Okay, let's see what else you got.
All right, so let's shift gears here real quick. So you're involved with SWIM, Smart Women in Music. SWIM has a summit coming up in October. I'm really fortunate that our Vice President of Operations, Misty Krestick, was selected to be there. And she's really excited to get to come out and be there. But tell me a little bit about SWIM, your involvement in SWIM, and this summit that's coming up.
Yeah. So Robin Walenta and Dee Dee came to me, God, it was about 3 or 4 years ago. And Robin had really kind of, she was, at the time, the chairman of the board for NAM. And she had this idea of, we kind of had tossed ideas over, I think a few cocktails along the way of, we really need to push this diversity initiative in our industry. And then, both being kind of women leaders and the idea that there's just not a lot of, in particular, women in leadership roles in the music industry. I mean, just in general, if you walk around the NAMM show, there's not a lot of women. But so we just really decided, let's take this on. Let's change it. And at the time, we're trying to like come up with like, well, what are the stats? And not that this is a perfect stat, but, we went to Music Trades and looked at all the companies that they publish in like Music Trades Top 200. And there was literally like 2.8% of the women or companies were run by women. I mean, it's just like astronomically low.
Top 200 list. So 2.8% would be roughly 5.
Exactly. So it was very low. Just overall, like, I mean, it's, just clearly a hole in the industry. And so we got together actually in Chicago and we sat down and wrote some pillars of like what we were trying to accomplish. And then came up with a game plan of like, how do we start conquering this? So what we came up with is kind of our initial kind of opportunities was to, first of all, at each of the NAMM shows to put on a networking event, bring people together to talk about this. And then at some of the other things like NASMD. And that's actually been really successful, not only in helping women build a network, but really just bringing attention to it. And it's been so interesting to me how many male counterpart CEOs have come to me and said like, hey, Crystal, I just looked around. I realized, gosh, I really don't have any women on my management team or leadership team, but I want to. So it got people thinking, I think. Like, I don't think it's that anyone was purposely doing it. It's just like, hey, we, you kind of have to be purposeful in looking for diversity. Mm-hmm. And so I've just been really impressed with both the fact that we started to call attention to it, and it got attention, and people really cared and wanted to make a difference. You know, mostly men in the role that could, which is who probably needs to, you know, help focus on changing this. And then just helping to create a network, because, you know, we all go to places where we feel comfortable, right? And I, before we started the podcast, we were talking a little bit about the power of NAM and coming together. And so, you know, I think we feel that connectivity to a lot of people when we get there. So how do we create that connectivity? So starting to do things like that. And then we started talking about, well, how do we support people at different parts of their journey, their career journey? So we looked at, for people early in their careers, how do we get them exposure? So we started a scholarship program to bring a couple of women to both the summer and winter NAM show. So we scholarship them to come to the show. And this is really designed for people in their first, like, kind of 5 years. They've been in the music industry. I think the requirement is maybe 2 years, not been to a NAM show. And when we come, we just give them this kind of like experience where not only they get to come, but they meet all of us. We bring them to networking events. They get mentorship with several different, you know, different women, kind of VIP seats for different things. So just kind
you're
of
spoiling them, basically.
Yes, spoiling them and instantly, hopefully making them feel like at home, right? Like, and excited to be in our industry so that
and
they
connected.
Want to stay in it.
Like they've got friendships, yeah. Relationships, connections.
Exactly. Connections, yeah. With like, you know,
holy cow.
Either like CEOs or the leadership team, C-suites of a bunch of big companies. Like, I mean, I think every time they've met, like, you know, Joe Lamont from NAM and the whole NAM team, like, I mean, they're getting to meet like kind of the who's who,
yeah.
On their first time, right? But now they, yeah. Have a connection. They could email or reach out to us or say hi. So that's kind of the first program. And then for people that are kind of more mid-career, women and their mid-career, we have the summit. And we did the first one literally like kind of the week before the world shut down for COVID. It's a program that is done through filling out an application. Honestly, we got so many wonderful applicants. It's like kind of hard to choose how to create kind of a class, basically. They come out to NAM headquarters, absolutely beautiful, in Carlsbad, California, San Diego. And it's a 3-day leadership training. We bring in a great consultant who works with them all day and does all sorts of different kind of workshops on communication, getting to know themselves, their communication styles. And then I think even more importantly, this little group of women that come to this thing, I mean, by the end, they're like best friends. And what I've seen with the first group, I think somewhere between 16 and 20, I'm not sure what the exact count ended up being, but we have a WhatsApp group. And I mean, it's just nonstop communicating. So this was, I mean, they came in, most of them not knowing each other at all, which we kind of purposely do. And they went out of this with like this unbelievable network, and they're keeping in touch. They're asking each other for advice, recommendations. I mean, a handful of them get like unbelievable promotions since we did this, or moved on to like new career opportunities. And they're just cheering each other on, supporting them. So kind of gave them a skill set, an extra skill set, great things that mm-hmm. we would all love. I mean, you and I would love to go do all these things. It's a really, really great education and just this group of trusted friends. And then after it, we ended up doing something also where we put them into kind of cohorts, and they met in this confidential forum led by the woman who led the leadership and kept them communicating. It was a couple hour commitment every month where they would bring kind of do like an update and then bring forth like kind of one problem and really work through how to solve it together. So that's a little bit about the leadership summit. So I'm thrilled you have someone coming. I think it'll be a great experience. And I will tell you, like walking out of that first one, it was one of the most rewarding experiences because it accomplished everything I dreamed of and more. So it's just,
that's awesome.
How can we do that exponentially for more people? But it was really, really cool.
I feel really honored because we not only have an employee going, but I have a former employee who's also going.
Oh, wow. And, that's great. Okay.
Yeah. She's the GM for, well, no, now she's the, I think she's, I don't know what if they use vice president or what title, but she's basically handles operations for Straight Music. And Rachel Dossi was
yes.
one of the people that kind of helped me grow Springfield Music, I think kind of in the second, sort of our second big growth phase that we had. And she was my right hand partner in crime that, you know, wouldn't have been possible without her. Yeah, very interesting to hear what the strategy is for swim in general. Hadn't heard it articulated that clearly before and didn't quite understand it. Matter of fact, when the summit was announced, I just mentioned to our, because our leadership team is with two women that are vice presidents in our company. It's like, well, you guys should certainly, you know, try to attend this, whatever this is. And so without really knowing what it was, just knowing who was involved in it, they both signed up, and one hadn't been in the industry long enough, but Misty had, and she was selected, and we were like, oh, cool, that's neat, and didn't really think much of it. And then at Summer NAMM, I ran into Robin Walenta at the swim reception. And she had mentioned, like, hey, you have someone coming to this, right? I was like, yeah, we do. And she's like, do you realize how big of a deal this is? She's like, I have employees that didn't get selected. I was like, okay, actually,
It was hard this year. There were so many applicants.
Tell me what this is. And so she's like, this is a big deal, Donovan. Like, that's exactly what she said. And she kind of walked me through it. I was like, oh, holy cow. Okay. I had no idea. So I came back and, you know, tried to make a bigger deal out of it with our people.
Yes, like,
I
didn't realize
this was such a big deal.
And for anybody listening, keep applying, because, like, there's just only so many spots, but we want everybody to get to come. Like, so, I mean, trying to create kind of a diverse group every time. So, you know, a piece of it has nothing to do with someone's qualification. It's just kind of the diversity of where everyone's from and different companies and different parts of the industry. Like, we'd love to get as many people through this over the next couple of years.
It sounds like a great plan to help fast track women into leadership positions. Cause you're right. Like, bringing someone in that's newer to the industry, because so many people, if they join our industry, if they're fortunate enough to go to a NAMM show, period, there's 100,000+ people there. And it can be one of the most loneliest experiences you can have when you first start. It can be hard to meet people. And if you're doing it through swim, it's just like from the get-go, you're going to be sort of vaulted into this, like, well, here's all the upper echelon of everyone you ever need to know. I almost feel like that's Tim Spicer's launch into NAMM was sort of that way, you know. It was sort of like, you know, hey kid, like, here's everybody you ever need to know. Now go be successful, which he certainly has. But you know, I'm envious of those people. I mean, happy for them, of course. But boy, someone would just be foolish to not take advantage of it. And if one is a business owner or business leader, you would want people to take advantage of that and the things that they're going to learn that they could come back and help you grow your business.
And there's just such a tool too, and having resources of people to talk to, right? Like, I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's all the time I pick up the phone and call people like, hey, have you heard about this? What do you think about that? You know, because it's really easy to be very centric in your own business, but to know what's going on in the marketplace or people dealing with similar issues. I mean, it's really powerful.
Well, and the other thing, it's not just knowing people, but it's knowing successful people that can help mentor and guide you through something.
And that you trust, right? Like, there's a trust to be able to share with them and that, you know, they have your best interests.
Yeah, being connected with people that are able to get shit done and that you trust and you trust their advice, like, that's worth it. That would be worth it if someone's listening and they own a music store or music business, and they don't have women in leadership, this would be worth going to find women that could be on your leadership
so
team.
So they can go.
So you could get them into this, it would be worth it. And you'd kind of mentioned something about, like, you know, this is a situation where in our industry in particular, that really we need men to kind of help proactively help to change this. And I do think the vast majority are certainly willing to do it. I don't think our situation we have of, and I may be wrong, this is just kind of my opinion, I'm open to having my opinion changed on this if you feel differently. So, but I feel like maybe the lack of leadership and the lack of diversity in our industry is not intentional. And I don't think who's currently involved in it, it's not by design. No. I think it's just things that have happened. And I know in our business, over the decades, we've always had a lot of women involvement and female leadership as well. But we've also had time periods where maybe the women that are in our business aren't as visible. And I notice in those time periods, like just thinking something as simple as retail staffing, the times in my store where I've had women retail staffers, more women apply. to work in the company, no, work for the company.
Yeah.
And then if at the times where I don't, because it is a guitar shop, sometimes we don't, then it's very, very difficult to get women to apply. And we always want them. I remember one year, for most of my 20 years here, we've almost always had women on the sales floor, women in the on the retail floor. But there's been a few times where we just don't. And I remember at one point it was getting so difficult that it was intentionally hiring marketing companies to help us write help wanted ads that would be more appealing to women without just saying, like, you know, if you have ovaries, please apply. Like we weren't trying to be like that blunt, but I was wanting to be sure, like, that I wasn't using language that would maybe drive women away. And that, more importantly, that I was using language that would pull them in. And so we were even going through that effort and that exercise to try to be inclusive, to bring them in. Cause I found, like, for us, it's been one of our keys to success to have women involved and involved in leadership positions as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, and it even goes like deeper. I mean, we've kind of have focused on the women's piece, but I think just diversity in general is such a positive. But you're right. Our industry just naturally doesn't have it in it. So it's like, it's not that anyone does it on purpose, but it's almost the other way. Like, you have to be purposeful and looking for it because it isn't naturally there.
Yeah.
So
they're out there to be found for sure. I mean, both of our VPs, both women, neither one were looking to be in the music industry. We just found them at a time where they were looking for a career change and something different. Thought they would give this a shot. And this ended up being not only a great career for them, but they've been game changers for the business. And so, yeah, they may not come into this with the same as other people will, like, oh, I don't care what it is. I just want to be in the industry. They don't, like, our VP of finance told me that specifically. She's like, she plays an instrument, but that this wasn't why she wants to be here. You know, it's not the gear that she cares about. You know, she wants to lead, and it's the people, and it's being able to be creative and do, you know, be able to make a difference. That means more to her than what cool new guitars came in. I say all that when there's guitars that come in that are in a color she likes or whatever, she tends to get just as excited as anybody else about that.
I mean, there's just something fun about being in, like, the creative space, right? So,
yeah, without a doubt. Well, I would encourage everybody, like, you need to proactively go out and get women on your team and on your leadership team. And then once you do, get them connected with SWIM, get them, you know, go for these scholarships, go to the SWIM meets. And fortunate enough to be involved with the SWIM Summit, you'd be crazy to not. It's a pretty nominal expense to the retailer. I think I'm flying her out there and paying for the hotel. I think that's basically right, what it's costing me.
And then we pay for everything once she's there.
Yeah. So, I mean, that you'd be silly to not do that. If nothing else, just for the connections she's going to make with the other women in that room will make it worth that expense. Absolutely. 10 times over. So interesting. Okay. So kind of rapid fire these last few questions.
Go for it.
What do you think is going to happen in our industry and in business over the next year? What's the prognostication?
I think it's good. I think it's strong. I do think there's going to be continued gaps in inventory and product availability, but it feels good.
How long do you think it's going to be until the wrinkles in the supply chain are ironed out and things are back to normal?
Next summer.
Really?
Yeah.
Less than a year. All right.
But I'm not saying it's perfect by then, but I think it's to the point we can, it's a lot, lot better.
All right. You heard it here first. I can make it this summer.
Next summer. So, let me know. When you see me at Summer NAMM or whatever exists.
Yeah, I'll tell you. Yep, you're right. You nailed it.
Whatever. The June NAMM, whatever we're calling it.
Yeah, the Summer NAMM, that'll be in Anaheim.
Right? Yeah.
All right. Is there a negative experience that you've had in your business career that ultimately had a positive effect, but you would never want to do it again?
Okay. That's a good one. Okay. So I'll tell you a funny one and then maybe a little more serious. Okay. So funny. We developed a line of drum bags that we thought were amazing. So we ordered a lot of them. And the drum bags came in, and all of the measurements were the external measurements versus the internal measurements. So we ended up with a lot of drum bags that were pretty much not sellable and tied up. Now, the positive side is, after about a year of trying every which way to sell these things, a guy came along that owned a hat store. and bought them. I mean, definitely pennies on the dollar, but bought them to move hats in. So
that's amazing.
So yeah, I mean, definitely a lesson and you know, dotting your I's across your T's.
Yeah,
and
measure twice
products.
And cut once.
That was a lot of years ago, and we definitely spend a lot of energy testing everything now with actual product. I think that was in a lot earlier days where, you know, there's a big expense to doing all that testing. We'll not make that mistake again. I don't know if that was a positive ending that some hat guy bought them, but better than nothing.
It wasn't, but you learned a lesson and survived it.
I don't know
what
was in them. Cowboy hats, sombrero hats, I have no idea. And I think probably the lesson, I think, you know, ultimately, I think we all say this, it comes down to the people. And, you know, I definitely feel like through the years, I've learned a lot of lessons in managing people, hiring people, and probably, you know, some hard lessons in hiring the wrong people. And sometimes, you know, their skills look great, but if they just don't have a passion for the business or the right culture, you know, I think that can really set you back, not only in where you're trying to go, but your whole team. And so I'd say, you know, kind of the lesson, and that I, you know, work really hard, and I think we all work hard to find the people that are going to be really passionate and about the business, really have a team attitude, and you know, get the culture. And culture doesn't mean we all want to be the same, right? I mean, culture is awesome to have lots of diversity in it, but that it all somehow comes together into some great melting pot. So I think, you know, some of the hardest lessons I've had are in people, hiring the right people. Say some other hard lessons and keeping the wrong people around too long, because maybe you like them, like you like them as people. And it's very rare that it's black and white that the person is not working. Like everyone does something good, maybe, you know, or something decent. So, you know, you can always find something that someone's done that has added value, but, you know, overall, if it's just not working, or, you know, I think, you know, those are some hard lessons and to learn. And, you know, the positive always is when you bite the bullet and make the changes that you need to make, or learn from your lessons. Like, hey, I shouldn't have ignored that little red flag, that little thing. I knew it, but I liked everything else, so I didn't pay attention to it.
You end up regretting it.
Yeah, you end up regretting it.
Yeah, culture piece is such an important piece, and I think it's probably the piece that everyone overlooks the most. And obviously, the more in need you are, the more that's the first thing that goes out the window, and it's the first thing that comes back to bite you in the ass.
Yeah. And especially if you're desperate, like you guys, you know, you don't have someone to be on the floor and you need, it's like, okay, well, fine, I got a warm body. But yeah, that only lasts for very short.
No. And if it's the wrong cultural part, it just ends up not being worth, they didn't solve the issue. They create 100 more.
And it hurts everyone else that's good, right?
Like it does. And you expressed it really well, that it's not just, you're not trying to get people that think and act like you. You want a diversity of opinion. You want diversity. And then if your culture is one that doesn't welcome diversity, then you've got a pretty shitty culture. So you might want to take a look at that. But your culture is still something that's defined, and it's something that can shift and will always move around. Yeah. And you want to make sure it's moving in the direction that you want it to go. And if it doesn't, you need to take action to turn it around. But I know when we did make that investment to bring in our VP of finance, that we were using an outsourced CFO at that point. Mm-hmm. And their recommendation was to replace them with a full-time person. And their first thing was, you know, I was very worried about the credentials, like what skills they need to have. And they said, you'll find almost everyone you hire will have that, because you're getting someone who's degreed and everything else. Like, don't worry about that. Your most important thing is you need to figure out the right cultural fit. Yeah. You need to find someone who will be a right fit for your culture. And I had to really think about, what is our culture? Like, what is that fit? What does that mean to us? And think of kind of what I was looking for. Jotted a few sentences of what I thought that looked like. And then the first person I talked to was Amanda, who's our VP of finance. And I was like, oh, she seems great. I'm going to keep looking, because I had a dozen other people to talk to. And I did talk to some really great people, but all of them, I kept coming back to her. I was like, no, she's the one. She's the one. And so finally I was like, I think after about 7 or 8, I'm like, I'm done. Like, I don't want her to go off somewhere else. Like, she's the perfect fit. And culture wise, she certainly has been. And that's we've been great. Really blessed to have people like that. But boy, you're right. That is such an important part. And it's something we sometimes will sacrifice when we get desperate, but it's a thing we should never let go. We should always keep that at the forefront. You had mentioned, you know, how marketing has kind of changed. You know, back in the day, you could just buy some ads in like Guitar World or whatever, and like that's all it took. And now things have changed. So as of today, the end of 2021, where are you putting most of your marketing efforts? Are you finding kind of a channel where you're able to find most of your customers? Is it AdWords? Is it social media? Is it TikTok, Instagram? Are you finding something that's working?
You know what I mean? So, good or bad, I mean, I think the issue is that you got to do it all. Because like you got to meet the customer where they are, and they're everywhere. I mean, it's just so scattered versus what it used to be, where you could just put an ad in a couple magazines and everybody read those magazines.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's where it takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of content generation. And then just realizing that you've got to be on all these different platforms. So does make, you know, how you spread your money, right? I mean, there's cost to a lot of it. There's a lot of time costs. Like even if you're building content people want to look at, it takes time. But I think you kind of just got to be everywhere. I start with just focusing on building great content. We got to have videos. We got to have short videos. We got to have longer videos. We got to have how-to videos. We got to have good photography. I think it's just all encompassing.
If you can be everywhere, be everywhere. But if you can't, maybe just find the one that you feel like that's where your customer base is at.
Yeah. I mean, then I guess you got to figure out where you're going to meet them the best. Right.
Yeah.
And you know, but things have changed. Like, I mean, you know, I definitely depends, I guess, a little bit on the demographics, but Facebook was everything. Facebook still is important, but Instagram's really important, you know? So, And YouTube is extremely important.
So yeah, I think it probably depends on one's business and who they're at. And if someone's a smaller retailer with, you know, half dozen employees or less than a dozen, you know, trying to do all the things is probably going to be difficult. But if you find that like you've got beautiful instruments and great photography skills, then something like Instagram could be a great thing. If you've got an employee who's really funny in small bits, then maybe TikTok is
the right thing.
Yeah. And you know, sometimes people get weird opinions about new social media. But honestly, if you're small, I would tell you, if there's something that's new coming up in social media that's starting to gain traction, like TikTok's actually past that. That's already like accepted as a social media thing. But jump on early, because that's actually the chance that you can. It's very hard for someone to start now on YouTube. Like that's going to be very, very difficult. My conversation I had with Lee Anderton from Anderton's Music, you know, he'd kind of mentioned like what a slog that would be today to start over. But the next big social media thing that comes up, if you're able to get in early, you can kind of claim your space for that more easily than you could otherwise. And a lot of times those big brands are late to get to that stuff. So
no, that's big retailers. Absolutely true. That's a great point. And I do think like you don't have to do it all yourself. And on a budget, there's so many clever ways to outsource this stuff. There's all sorts of, you know, where you can go and use these different sites to do design work for you for really inexpensive to write strategy for you. Like here is a social media strategy. Post, you know, these 5 times a week, post this kind of content each time. I mean, there's a lot of ways where it's not a huge expense to be pretty smart at it. So I think maybe sometimes people feel like they just got to take it all on themselves. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I mean, we've had really great luck with crowdsourcing a lot of different, you know, projects.
Any sites stand out that have been really effective in doing that? Like, honestly, what are you using to outsource those platforms?
Oh my gosh, I'd have to ask our VP of marketing. I know we used to use like 99 designs, but there's another one she uses now. But yeah, I mean, there's a handful of them that you can source. Well, I mean, Upwork is one.
Mm-hmm.
You ever use Upwork?
I have in the past. What have you used Upwork for specifically?
I mean, we've used it for everything from clipping photos, doing videos, but yeah, 99 designs, Upwork, Fiverr.
Yes. What have you done on Fiverr?
So, I mean, we have outsourced everything from not the actual photography, but clipping it, turning it into videos, making presentations. I mean, there's people out there who are literally like, you know, they can give you 30 great social posts and it's really affordable. And then there's people like, if you get on Upwork, that are like social social media strategy and like a couple thousand dollars and they'll write a strategy for you. Because I think sometimes like we feel like we need to like bring it all in-house and figure it all out ourselves. Or like go to some, you know, you can't afford to go to some big agency.
Yeah.
You really don't have to. There's so many smart people out there that kind of do this work freelance. I used Upwork for, I had a big presentation I needed to do that was for like a board I was on and I didn't want to like ask my marketing team to help. So I like, you know, I did a PowerPoint presentation that looked like, you know, not that beautiful. Then I found somebody on Upwork that turned it into this like, you know, all these like great graphs and slides, like took my kind of, you know, I don't know, not great, done in Excel yeah. graphs and turned them into these beautiful things. I think she charged me like $300.
It's money well spent.
Yeah. So I don't know. I would just like challenge thinking outside the box, I guess. Like you can take on a lot of these marketing endeavors because there's young people out there that have the skills and know how to do it. And they'll just do like some freelance work.
Yeah.
And the nice part about using one of those sites like Upwork or something is, you know, it definitely keeps track of it all and you don't have to pay them until it's done. So if you don't like them, it's easy to move on to the next person.
Exactly. They didn't quit a job and, you know,
like we have someone that we found on Upwork that's doing all of our catalog work. So a lot of times like too, like we've found where like we've created a relationship, like met them on Upwork, did some stuff with them. It all worked well. And then we kind of took it off Upwork and just, you know, pay them directly.
Yeah. Now. That's great. All right. You've inspired me. I'm going to go look at it. Okay. The final question is if you could send a message to the younger you, what would you say?
Oh, okay. Younger me. I think, okay, first to be a great listener. You know, I think sometimes we get ahead of like wanting to tell our opinion or our thoughts. And I think being a great listener, we can learn so much. So I think that, I guess like this kind of, and it's kind of been a theme we've kind of hit on, but I love this like fostering diversity. That definitely my younger self wasn't thinking about that. And not just diversity, like fostering other people's success. You know, I think that leading with that idea of how do I help others be successful, find their place, it comes back in spades. So, you know, I think that a lot of times like our younger self, my younger self was like trying to figure out how to like find my spot, get ahead. And, you know, so I think going back, I think if I would have focused more on others, I think that, you know, and just being a good listener, a good steward, I think it all works out. Like do the right thing and it all comes around and it's great. So I don't know. So maybe it's just a little bit of slow down. And then, you know, I personally like to have fun. I like, you know, I like to always keep it fun. You know, we're not curing cancer here. And so I think just, you know, keeping that positive, happy attitude and making sure to share it is always makes me feel good and makes everybody feel good. So, you know, we're lucky we're in a great business. It's a passion business. It's all about making people feel good.
You know, that's great advice. I think it's hard for young people to probably take that advice, especially those of us with a certain type of personality, because we want, you know, it's hard to listen because we want people to hear that we're smart and then we have ideas. And it can be hard to kind of sometimes slow down and enjoy it because you're trying to move forward. But it's certainly great advice to at least try to share. Some of us.
Oh, wait, I got another one. I wish my younger self would have bought a lot of Apple stock.
Yeah, nice. Apple stock and a slightly younger self, maybe Bitcoin.
Bitcoin, yeah. Tesla.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. Well, this has been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed the conversation with you. I'm really grateful that you were able to make the
Absolutely.
Time to do it.
Thank
and want to encourage everyone who's listening to, if you don't have women on your leadership team, go out and get them. There's lots of women out there and they will transform your team without a doubt. And then immediately get them involved in SWIM. And even if you do and or don't have women on your leadership team and you happen to be a guy, you can still be involved with SWIM. You can still support SWIM. They'll allow you to come to the SWIM receptions.
Absolutely.
Stuff Everyone's like that. Welcome. And they're looking for all the allies and advocates that they can get.
At Springfield Music, we started using Merchant Cost Consulting earlier this year. These guys are former banking and credit card reps who go and negotiate your processing rates on your behalf. Now, like most of you, we're pretty aggressive about shopping our processing rate around, so I wasn't sure they'd be able to save us much money. But boy, was I wrong. On average, they're saving us about $600 a month.
The deal is we split it 50-50 with them for so many months, and after that, all the savings are ours to keep. Plus, they keep an eye on your fees during this time to make sure those freaking credit card processors don't find a way to jack up your rate again. They're good folks, and they do what they say they do. Actually, in our case, they underpromised and over-delivered. They estimated about $500 a month in savings, and it's been closer to $600. When you contact Patrick at Merchant Cost Consulting, tell him that Donovan Bankhead sent you. This does two things. One, they will pay me a slight referral commission. But more importantly, two, you'll get 10% off of your first month's bill if you choose to go with them after their free analysis. Listen, I wouldn't recommend it to you if it wasn't worth it. It'll only take a few minutes of your time. They handle the rest. Contact Patrick McClellan. His email is patrick@merchantcostconsulting.com. P-A-T-R-I-C-K at merchantcostconsulting.com. I'll even give you a cell phone number, 508-733-7622. And remember, tell them that Donovan sent you.
Well, that's a wrap for this episode. If you'd like help with your business, check out musicretailconsulting.com for articles, resources, and coaching and consulting services. Also, you can subscribe to this podcast so you're aware of future updates and rate and review while you're at it. Thanks for listening.